Okay, yes. Thanks, everyone. And the topic today is objectivity, which is a huge topic in philosophy, with applications in every branch from metaphysics to epistemology to ethics and politics and aesthetics. And even within metaphysics and epistemology, it has somewhat different meanings that we can't cover all of them today. What I want to do is talk about the meaning of objectivity as a trait, a personal trait. And I'm going to start by telling you a story. When I taught logic at College Logic at Vassar years ago, I had a section on definitions. I would teach the students that a proper definition has a genus and differentia, the genus being the wider class that a concept belongs to, and the differentia being the essential traits that distinguish that class of things from everything else in the genus. So we did a bunch of exercises, and the culminating one, which was my favorite, I asked him to define the word objective. And when the students recovered their breath at this massive, what seemed like a massive task I was asking them, we just got started. I said, look, just bear with me. What is the genus of objective? What kind of objectivity? What kind of thing is it when we're talking about? Someone would say, well, it means out there in reality, like objects, what's, objective facts or objective reality. I'd say, yeah, that's one meaning. I want to focus on the way in which the trait of a person who's objective. I mean, when you take an exam, you're hoping that I will be objective in grading it and not, give preference to your rational. Objective preference to some people, students over others. So let's talk about that. All right, what's the opposite? What are we contrasting it, objectivity with? Well, obviously being subjective. Okay, that was easy. Do these terms apply to physical traits like strength or the heartbeat or something? No, Mr. Kelly, they're mental things. They have to, and specifically of what kind of mental things? Well, I guess we're talking about thinking, cognitive stuff, right? Yeah, right. Okay, next question. Does objectivity mean the same thing as being correct? Does it mean the same thing as truth? Can a person be, for example, objective and be trying to find out what the truth is, but not haven't found it yet, or even maybe getting to a bad conclusion, but on rational reasons. Okay, yeah. So what that we have our genus. It's a cognitive commitment to a certain kind of process of thinking. Great. Now let's talk about the differentia. What's the opposite? You said it's subjective before. Okay, what does that mean? Well, like bias, or someone is prejudiced, or is just very emotional and not thinking clearly. Okay, right, that's good. So what's the difference between what makes someone objective as opposed to being subjective? Someone will always, almost always say, well, it's the consensus. The consensus is, if someone says something and others can verify it or as true and agree with it, okay, that makes it objective. Well, can the majority be biased? Can it be prejudiced? I guess so. Someone else will say, it means disinterested. It means calm, unemotional, disinterested, Dr. Spock-like. Well, could you be Could you be really interested in the topic and have a lot of you really, really want to find out what's going on? Well, okay. You don't have to be calm necessarily. Someone will say, how about being logical? That was a round-nosing suggestion because they were in a logic course I was teaching. Yeah, I would say, but sometimes a paranoid can seem very logical or conspiracy theory. What's the difference? And finally, we would get to, you have to want to grasp the facts. And you have to be seeking it logically, yes, but you have to want to grasp the facts. So, conclusion. So I would summarize their reflections, and I would say, so objectivity means a commitment to finding the truth. It's a feature of the process of thinking that involves that commitment by using rational methods, like actively seeking relevant information, remaining open to new evidence, putting aside distorting factors, subjective factors like wishful thinking, etc. Yep, that's it. Sounds easy, right? Only a few of the undergraduate students in that class had taken any other philosophy course. But just by thinking about the question with a little Socratic help from me, they came up with a better definition than most philosophers. And I always took great pleasure in this because my colleagues in the philosophy department, the other faculty, would. Some of them were dead set against the whole idea of objectivity. And here were my students, coming up with a good definition of a highly abstract concept. So they rightly took pride in it. And as I say, it made me happy. But the issue of understanding objectivity in this sense goes. It's harder as we go deeper. The definition makes it clear that objectivity involves both a choice and a skill. The commitment to finding the truth is the choice. The ability to use rational methods, however, is a skill. And I want to say a little bit more about each side of that duality. And I'm going to start with the skill. And just to put this in a larger context, there's a lot we could say about objectivity, and objectivists, including myself, have written a lot about what's wrong with the attacks, many attacks on objectivity. But my goal today is to drill deeper into what it is that objectivity is. Regardless of what anyone thinks about its possibility, that could be a great another topic. And in fact, I want to point you, if you want to pursue the issue, to two sources. One is Stephen Hicks, who I see on the call today, has a very nice paper. You'll find it if you go to our website and look at the staff page, the scholars page, and his bio, and he has an article on objectivity for actual people that I highly recommend. And also, if you go to our the Atlas Intellectuals page, the landing page for Atlas Intellectuals, you will find and drill down and scroll down a bit, you will find a whole section on objectivist epistemology includes a ton of material on objectivity. But so that's just background. I want to start by talking about the method of objectivity, the methods and their skill. I mentioned earlier, well, it means, actively seeking relevant information, remaining open to new evidence, etc. And that's a good starting point. But let's drill a little further down. Epistemology and the epistemological analysis of how knowledge, what constitutes knowledge, and the cognitive capacities we have, proceeds in stages. The basic stage is the perception of objects in our environment, from which we then, noting similarities and differences, we form concepts, the uniquely human capacity, and concepts for categories of things like tables and chairs, or features of things like their color, their shape, their size. And then at a certain point, we are able to put our concepts together into propositions that make a statement about reality, either true or false. The goal being to get, true ones that involve typically starting with applying concepts we've formed to the new things that we've perceived. But we also use logical processes like induction to infer general conclusions about causality. Fire burns, a round ball will roll, etc. And then we also use deduction to apply those general truths once learned to new instances. And beyond that, we formulate theories to explain the generalizations that we've seen through hypotheses and testing by experiment, often about hypothetical entities that we cannot perceive, like atoms and so forth. So it's a process. And there are certain principles in the objectivist epistemology that govern the process. One is to keep track of the hierarchy. All the conclusions have to trace back ultimately to observations. The observations we make every day in our lives and the experimental observations we make when we're testing hypothesis. Perception is the ground floor. It's not just the starting point for a baby or child. It is epistemology recapitulates ontogeny here, because the even once we've acquired a massive body of knowledge, what makes that knowledge has to be traced back to our perceptual awareness. We're also, another principle is that we're not omniscient. We're not infallible. That's the nature of knowledge. And so we need to continue an inquiry when there's evidence that you need more evidence, which is often the case. We have a hypothesis that we've tested partially, but we haven't tested other aspects of it, or we haven't tested other factors that might be causally relevant. And there's also the importance in thinking of distinguishing between what we know for sure, what we're confident of, and what's only probable, what needs more evidence. This is sometimes called metacognition. It's awareness of how you're doing in the cognitive process of discovering facts. So that's the a capsule summary of the objectivist epistemology. It's not unique to objectivism, but it's certainly a piece of it. But let's go even a little further. Beyond the general standards that apply to all knowledge, there are specialized methods used in biology, chemistry, astronomy, or any other branch of science. Think of those techniques that you have to learn in graduate school in those sciences, and by being an apprentice to those who have mastered them. Again, think of the methods that a lawyer has to learn in order to research the precedents that are relevant to a case, how to prepare a brief and present it to in a trial, how to write a contract that will survive litigation. Think of the techniques for project management that enable, for example, builders to build skyscrapers. That's a huge undertaking involving many, many people, and it has to be organized in some way. And project management techniques, and including very sophisticated software now, makes it possible for us to build on a scale we couldn't before. And project management applies to so many different fields. I could go on and on into medical research, but I hope you get the idea. These specialized methods are themselves products of knowledge. That is, we're not born with them, and the philosophical epistemology doesn't indirectly imply them. These are methods that were evolved by people in specialized fields who learned new ways of doing things and incorporated those insights into their methods to achieve more sophisticated, more advanced knowledge. Now, no one could master all these methods. It would be impossible. And we can't make the impossible, right? Here, a requirement for objectivity. But I think we can require, as part of the virtue, moral virtue of objectivity, which I'll get to in a minute, we can require that people learn and exercise the basic methods of concept formation and definition, the basic methods of logical inference, some awareness of the fallacies that we can, that we're subject to and need to avoid, like ad hominem, and so forth. And we can also expect people to have some degree of metacognition, that is, some way of assessing whether they actually know something as opposed to merely believing or imagining or wishing it to be true. That is a base level of objectivity. But even in the advanced, more technical methods, which specialists use, those methods and techniques were evolved and applied for the sake of objectivity, to discover the truth, to develop rationality in a specific, detailed, technical way that addresses the particular realm of reality that they are addressing. So this is a huge part of epistemology, is to understand those methods, and also of logic and branches like statistics and all the methodology courses that you take in almost whatever field you are doing, majoring in or working in. And I don't just mean academic fields, I mean any field of practice. I mentioned law, project management, there are many, many others. So respect for those methods and commitment to using methods as needed and learning the methods as needed is a part of what we mean by objectivity. So that said, let me just somewhat more briefly address the other side, the other main distinction, the choice, the commitment to truth. That commitment means recognizing that reality is what it is, regardless of what we think or feel about it. Facts are facts. As a choice, on the objectivist view, objectivity is an exercise of free will, a voluntary choice to seek truth. So in that respect, objectivity is not just a technique or method, it is a moral virtue. It's a core element, a core element, in fact, of the virtue of rationality, which is the fundamental virtue in the objectivist ethics. And the opposite choices, the failure to make that commitment, there are many such things, and most of them will be familiar from those of you who have read Rand's novels or some of the psychological works by Nathaniel Branden and others. There's evasion, blank out. The idea it won't be real if I shut my mind to it. Or reliance on non-rational methods like emotions, faith, and authority because objectivity is too scary or whatever. There's the anti-conceptual mentality, which doesn't even try to function on a truly conceptual way, but treats concepts as memorized words or concretes. These rejections of objectivity are willful. They are vices that are, in contrast to the virtue of being objective. But I also want to note, this is my final point, that objectivity can be compromised by cognitive biases. And those biases often operate below the surface of conscious awareness and control. So the question of to what extent they are voluntary or reflect voluntary commitments is tricky. I do believe that they can be, I mentioned confirmation biases. This is a huge, a large field of study in
I have a
cognitive
bit of a
psychology. Confirmation bias is the best known, and there are others. The point is that they're not fully voluntary, and but they can be countered by voluntary actions, including methods. So cognitive biases are an interesting phenomenon because they involve both getting to a point where you can choose not to be confirmation bias or any of the others. But they also involve the methods of countering them are themselves methods. So they involve both the volitional and the methodological aspect. And I'm going to that's going to be my subject in the clubhouse I'm doing next month, April 28th, cognitive bias. So I'm happy to take questions on that point, but remember that we've got there's more to come down the road. So
Thank you.
thanks. Let's open to questions.
Terrific. Thank you, David. I've also asked my colleague Lawrence to help me be a moderator because I have a not a great connection here. I want to acknowledge on the stage some of our other faculty, Professor Jason Hill, Professor Stephen Hicks, Professor Richard Salzman. I know we also have Rob Drasinski in the room, though he is listening at the moment. He's caught up in something. I wanted to let everybody know the paper that David referred to. I've put it in the pinned link. So if you want to check it out, do so now, because I'm going to be replacing that with David Kelly's booklet, The 7 Habits of Highly Objective People. I'd love to ask those of you who are here, please share this room. You can do it with the button at the bottom of your screen. You can share it on Clubhouse, share it on any other social media platform you're on. Stephen, thanks for sharing that. And Jason, do you have some reflections on what David shared?
Yes, thank you very much, David. And I do have one question. It seems that the question of objectivity, on one respect, seems a little bit moot on Rand's account of objectivity, given the fact that for Rand, awareness of existence is perceptual and perception is, she claims that awareness of existence is first perceptual and perception is infallible. So, one of the things that I think distinguishes Rand from Aristotle is that Aristotle is a biological essentialist and Rand is an epistemological essentialist. And when I teach her book, Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, in conversation with Aristotle's The Organon, and more particularly the posterior analytics, we always, the students and I always get into this big thing about what's the difference between a biological essentialist and epistemological essentialist. And some of them think that Rand sort of falls on the side of a lightweight nominalist. But I wanted to ask David more particular if, because I've always had a problem with this idea that Rand does share with Aristotle that perception has a built-in infallibility clause to it, which already safeguards objectivity as a method, right? So David was talking about methods. So my sense is, what proof do we have? I think Rand treats it almost axiomatically that objectivity, perception is infallible. And I want to know David's thoughts on this, because that seems quite problematic to me. If perception is infallible, I do think that you can't prove that existence exists, that's an axiom, true. But to say that awareness of existence is perceptual, which is true, and then to make the move that perception is infallible seems a little bit more legwork is needed. I don't see where perception itself is infallible. I know she shared this with Aristotle, and I've always had a little bit of a problem unpacking that kind of assertion. So David, can you help me out a little bit as someone who's very, very, very familiar with Rand's epistemology and Aristotle's The Organon? Can you help me out here?
Yes, I think so. It's a big topic, and I dealt with it at some length in one of my books, The Evidence of the Senses. But I would put it this way. What are the roots of the concept of fallibility? It means capable of error. What is an error? It is a misrepresentation of reality. But perception doesn't represent reality. It is what we see, what we hear, what we touch, the experience we get is not subject to volition, and it is the causal result of an interaction between our sense organs and the object and objects, things in the environment. And it is, we see whatever that combination dictates causally, so to speak. Whatever results from that interaction between our perceptual capacity and the world outside. You have to find what is the first level at which error is possible. And I would say it's only at the level of the perceptual judgment. When I say, you know, I look at use a classic example, the stick that looks bent in water because of refraction. I look at it and I say, oh, it's bent. That's a judgment. It is not a direct perception. What I actually see is, you know, what you could draw in a diagram. There's a stick in a glass of water, and there appears to be a bend. The appearance is what it has to be, given optics, given the nature of light, and the stick and the water and refraction, et cetera. It can't be wrong. It just is what it is, any more than, you know, your heart can be wrong in skipping a beat if, you know, you have a heart murmur or whatever. That just happens. We can say, you know, these things are not what we call illusions like this one. Can be described as, or in a sense, are problems in our interaction with the world, as is the heart murmur. They don't serve our lives, and we find solutions to them. But the heart murmur itself is not. Sorry about that. I'm sorry, I have my window shut. But I'm in a busy street in downtown DC. with ambulances, fire trucks, and everything going by. I hope that's over now. The Heart Murmur is not a show that the heart is fallible. That concept and that statement makes no sense. And I would say the same thing is true of calling a perception fallible or infallible. It is what it is. Fallibility has to be connected with the concept of error versus truth, and that applies only at the conceptual level. Even the simple conceptual level, when I say, "Oh, the stick is bent," it looks bent, and from that, and that's a perceptual phenomenon. But when I form the concept, when I use the concept bent to apply to it, I'm wrong. And we quickly learn this is such a trivial example, no one's fooled by it anymore. But fallibility exists only where truth. There's an issue of truth or falsity, and I think that applies only to judgments, statements, propositions. I take it that is the essence of what Rand and I think Aristotle, you know Aristotle better than I do, but I think that's the essence of what they were getting at.
But briefly, David, there could be some sort of cortical. I mean, when we perceive with our senses, and there could be any kind of aberration or some sort of. Let's just see, say we're looking at something, and there's some sort of cortical oddity that is going on with the sense of sight, and or we're touching something, or we're smelling something, and there's some sort of malfeasance with our olfactory apparatus. It does seem to me that there can be some way in which we properly misperceive reality because of the intrusion of something quite aberrant in our sense perception. And those have to be taken into account because those are not even exceptional cases. There are many ways in which there are any number of us who are walking around with compromised senses or in which our senses are compromised and we misperceive things in the world. I don't know. I'm still having problems accepting the fact that perception is infallible because that would then presuppose that the manner in which we perceive the world, which is through our senses, themselves come built in with a kind of infallibility disposition or orientation. And it just seems to me that that rules out all sorts of ways in which our sense apparatuses, if I'm not committing any grammatical infelicities here, the plural of apparatus, I don't know what that is, but are themselves deeply compromised in many ways.
Well, it's certainly possible for factors to interrupt, distort, or distort the operation of the proper normal operation of the senses, the proper operation of our senses, which have evolved in order to give us fine grained awareness of a world within a certain range of visual, electromagnetic energy, tactile, whatever. That form of energy applies to touch, chemical, the chemical senses, taste and smell. These things can be are subject to well-known phenomena, like you're out in the sunlight and you come into a room and it seems very dark. Whereas if you were had been in the room in your office all day, it would seem, normal illumination. That is an adjustment that evolution has provided us with to save our eyes from burnout. And they accommodate, they adapt. That's actually that happens to be a very positive adaptation, but it can lead you to make a wrong perceptual judgment, if you come out from the bright sunlight and walk into a room and say, "Oh my God, turn on the light. It's almost midnight in here." That's a judgment, though. The terms that we that are properly applied to perception in terms of evaluating it would be like, think of going to an eye doctor and look at the eye chart. Can you read this line? Yes. Okay. How about the next one? Okay. There's a degree of specificity in for every sense. In the visual case, it is what are the smallest units you can detect and discriminate. Not even that's kind of a tricky example because the eye chart, you have to name letters, which is a conceptual faculty. But anyway, it's testing your eyes. If the doctor, that the ophthalmologist then puts drops in your eyes and you're not going to see as well for a while because your pupils will be enlarged. That is, but you're still seeing what you're seeing with whatever degree of specificity you can. Specificity is a feature that is properly applied to the senses. And I think it's fundamental, essential feature, but it doesn't mean truth or falsity. If I'm nearsighted and can't see as sharply as you, it just means my perception is not as sharp. So this is a complicated issue, Jason, and a lot more we could say, but.
All right. Well, we have about 20 more minutes and a lot of people on the stage. I'd love to get more of the audience involved. So please, folks, raise your hand. We'll bring you on up. We have almost our full faculty here. There's one, Antonella had to leave the room, but Stephen or Richard or Rob, did you want to weigh in?
Well, this is Richard. This is just very interesting. I did want to ask quickly, I have noticed lately that in recent years, there has been greater attention to biases, prejudices, categorizing them, which I think is a good thing. But do you, like I, notice that it is sometimes used to undergird skepticism? So it's a good thing in the sense that you want to not make logical mistakes. But I wonder if it's being used instead to say we can't escape these biases. And when the lists proliferate, and you can find them anywhere on the web, all the ways you can go wrong. I wonder whether you think that's a good thing, a bad thing, and a related question. Knowing the laws of logic in a positive sense is central, I would think, to objectivity. But to what extent do you think also should be studied the fallacies? I think unless I'm wrong, Aristotle, not only is the father of logic, but listed and explained the major fallacies as well. Do those need as much attention as the rules of logic to get this right? That's my question. Thanks, David.
Okay, quickly, on your first question about cognitive biases, yes, that has been used by skeptics and people who are hostile to objectivity. But that is a exercise of huge bad faith because they are relying on the cognitive bias literature is based on a lot of experiments by psychologists and others. And if we're all biased, then those scientists are biased and we can't trust their results. Maybe they're just, talking about confirmation bias because they're subject to it and they're just reaffirming their own expectations in their so-called experiments. That's a self-refuting proposition. In The Art of Reasoning, the fifth edition that I came out a year and a half ago with my co-author, Debbie Hutchins, we added a chapter on cognitive bias, and that's a point we make up front. There's an issue about how difficult it is to counter these things, and that's a valid issue, I think. But to say that they are disabling like any attack on objective knowledge, it relies on, you know, some kind of objective knowledge to establish it. If I say, "But you know, I'm not subject to bias." Oh, yes, you are, David. Well, prove it. Well, Daniel Kahneman has shown in this research that I said he showed, he found an actual result about human cognition. Is that true? Okay, if it is, then it only confirms that there is a truth and that we can find it. That's my short answer to the first question. The second question about fallacies, I would say, is it's a difficult subject. My book on logic is in the fifth edition now. I've been, you know, did the first edition back in the late 80s. And every logic book, comparable one, has a chapter on fallacies. It's most popular. Most used chapter in almost any book, and partly because students love it, they get to learn about ad hominem, and they go accuse their peers or their parents. Oh, yeah, that's an ad hominem argument. But I think these are useful, and as the more we know about ways thinking can go wrong, the better our chances of having it go right. And so the important thing is getting it right by the methods of observation, logic, the normal epistemological standards. But because knowledge or conceptual knowledge is fallible, knowing the ways that we can fail is extremely useful, in the same way that in medicine, knowing the ways the body can be subject to disease or injury helps us maintain our health better.
Thank you, David.
All right. We have Professor Hicks and Rob Trusinski. I don't know if either of you had wanted to weigh in.
If I can talk, Jen, Jag, I think there's kind of a commonality between those last two things about perception and the quote-unquote fallibility of perception. I like the point, by the way, that perception isn't really fallible or infallible, that doesn't really apply to perception. It just is. But I think with both the fallacies thing, I'm working on a review of Steven Pinker's recent book on rationality, because he's been in the thick of all this cognitive bias kind of stuff. And he actually, I think he does a good job of making the point that, you know, the cognitive bias thing has been overdone, that people delight in pointing out all the ways people can get things wrong. And the point is actually that we can get things right. And that the point of identifying cognitive biases is so that we can avoid them and actually get the right answers. And not so we can, you know, basically say the human mind is totally messed up and can't do anything. But I think in both cases, you know, there's that Ayn Rand's argument about the stolen concept there, that the only reason we can identify something as a cognitive bias is by comparison to knowledge we have that's not biased, that's correct. And the only reason we can identify a perception as distorted is by comparison to the majority, you know, to the general normal rule of our perception, which is that it's giving us an accurate information about the world. What I wanted to add is I think also that in the issue, in talking about objectivity, I think that, and it comes up in this issue of perception. And the way I think of view perception is that it's causal, not that it's fallible or infallible, but that it's causal. A solid ground from which students and to make inferences is that, you know, there's no evil demon deceiving you in there, that it is a cause and effect relationship, and then your job as a thinker is to figure out what is that cause and effect relationship and sort that out. But I also think that may apply more broadly to the question of objectivity, that objectivity really is about grasping that between reality and knowledge, there is a cause and effect sequence that you have to follow. And objectivity is grasping that there is a cause and effect sequence and then figuring out what it is and making sure that you follow it. So that's just my two cents.
Thanks, Rob. I just want to, you broke up a little bit there, but I want to say, thank you for bringing up the stolen concept. That's exactly what I was talking about without naming it, and you named it. So that's great. With the idea that knowledge is causal, perception is, and there's a lot of causality involved in thinking, obviously, because we're exercising a cognitive capacity, which has its neurological basis and is as well as psychological influences, pro and con, including our knowledge of methods. However, in the conceptual realm, in the middle of causal sequences is choice, our ability to focus or not, to evade or not. And that's what makes it moral in the way that being nearsighted is not a sign of immorality. So anyway, thanks for that. And did I see Stephen up?
Yes, I'd like to jump in. A couple of things. I'm curious about your faculty colleagues whom you mentioned in many cases are hostile to the notion of objectivity. I wonder if you had some thoughts about what seem to be the main junctures that take them off in that direction. Given that your students seemed, unspoiled and they can go through the exercise, but what is the great resistance? Have they just talked themselves out of any sort of understanding of objectivity, or are there other forces at work?
I think both things are at work here. I mean, as you know, Stephen, better than I do from your study of postmodernism, that there are a raft of philosophical objections to the idea of objectivity, going back to the Greeks, that it's selective, that it's it depends on our particular kind of sense organs and conceptual apparatus, that it's fallible, we can't be sure. How do you know you're not wrong? The evil demon example from Descartes and its modern variant, the brain in the vat example. And so there are a lot of those things that anyone in philosophy, anyone who's teaching philosophy has been steeped in. And not many of them know that we've got the answers to those things. They haven't read Ayn Rand. They haven't read my evidence of the senses. But there's also, the choice side, what I'm calling the choice of the commitment side, there are people that really, this includes intellectuals, who really don't want to be bound by reality. And I think particularly for example, Stephen, one of the points you make in your book explaining postmodernism and in various lectures you've given is that the attack on objectivity served the purpose of being able to evade everything that's wrong with socialism so they, its adherents could still be socialists, right? And that's a motive. It's not a logical policy. So that's a short answer, but
Stephen, did you have you might have an answer to your own question in your many decades of teaching?
I guess I do, but while David is the main man on stage, I'm just wondering if in the whole raft of reasons, setting aside the bad motives, if in David's experience, he could identify maybe one or two that seem to be most persuasive on intelligent, philosophy students that lead them down that path, the ones that we then should strategically focus on?
Well, that's a great question, Stephen, and I have to think more if you have a good answer to it. Just for now, what I would say is that one of the more innocent motives is innocent objections to objectivity is the idea that we could be wrong. And sometimes historically we have found out that things we believed were wrong. And so the issue of certainty it's not a hard or necessarily irrational jump from we're prone to error to can we be certain of anything? And, you know, there's some real epistemological challenges, I think, in answering that question fully. So that's my take off the top of my head about the more innocent, but I think pretty common objection.
Thank you. Roger, you've been here. I'd love to know if you had a take on this or any applications to what we're experiencing now with all of the sharp divisions.
Yeah, my question for David is in regards to free will and how it applies to objectivity. Obviously, we can observe that we have the ability to think, and if we can think, then we are choosing to think, and we know this. That there's evidence of that, right? If somebody says something that we disagree with, we can then think about it. And there's if somebody persuades us with an argument, our minds can be changed. And so that ability to think, I think, proves out free will. But my question for you would be, are you open to the idea that compatibilism, which would suggest that some things are predetermined, but that you do have this limited range of choices? Could compatibilism be compatible with objectivity?
Okay, boy, that's a big one. Thanks, Roger. Let's clarify first of all the term compatibilism. In philosophy, that term is normally used to mean a form of determinism. That is, every thought, choice, and action is causally necessitated by prior states of the person and the environment. But within those, among those thoughts, choices, and actions, some are reflections of inner motives as opposed to cognitive and emotional factors that are inside the person and are mental rather than, say, a reflex. The doctor hits your knee, and if your reflexes are working, you don't have any choice about your reaction. Or if, I hate to use the example, but if a car hits you, there's no choice about that you're going to go down. But I think your sense of compatibilism here is that there's a large degree to which our thoughts, what's going on in our psychology, in our actions, is subject to causal factors, but with some room for free choice. And that is exactly what I consider the free choice position, because obviously, there's a lot of causality going on in our minds. Lots of examples, but if you see something that is scary, you're going to feel fear. You don't choose to feel fear. It just happens. That's the way your emotions work. Or take a cognitive example. It was a famous example. In, I'll take the example from Atlas Shrugged. At one point, Eddie Willows has a meeting in Hank Reardon's hotel room about a business transaction, and Hank is just gotten up. He's wearing his robe with his initials HR on it. Okay, no big deal. Then, much later, Eddie is in Dagny's apartment helping her pack. She's got to leave in a hurry. And he notices in her closet this blue robe that has HR on it. And suddenly, he can't help drawing the conclusion, oh my God, they're lovers. So there are lots of things like that. But we have, there is a domain in which we have to exercise thinking. And even in my example of Eddie, he could have blanked it out. He could have. A lot of characters in Atlas were doing that. Eddie is a good guy, so he didn't. But the search, trying to solve a problem, inventing a motor, running a railroad, all these things take a lot of thought. You can, choose to exercise a higher or lower degree of focus on, or choose not even to take account, evade facts. So does that clarify it at all, Roger?
Yeah, I guess what I'm hearing is that it may just be a definition problem. And I'm probably not the best person to make this argument. I was just kind of curious, if I were to say that I believed in compatibilism, I guess the yes-no question would be, is compatibilism consistent with objectivity?
I would say no, because I don't think there can be objectivity unless you are in control of your mind, in the sense, and including a volitional control. Because on a strictly determined, a fully determinist basis, even a compatibilist one, you can't step back. Your conclusions, your thoughts are going to be governed by antecedent factors. Now, you can raise questions about them introspectively, but those are also governed. And this is called the contradiction of determinism, that you can't fully justify even the determinist position, because if you're a determinist, you hold that you're very acceptance of determinism was causally necessitated, not by the facts, but by causal factors, not by your grasp of reality, but by forces acting on you, inside or outside.
All right. Well, that takes us right
Thank you.
Up to the top of the hour. I want to thank our founder, David Kelly, for this illuminating discussion. Also, extremely grateful to the rest of our faculty, Jason, Stephen, Richard, Rob, and I've added in here the link to our upcoming events. Today we have our Morals and Markets seminar. This is a program for students and recent graduates. So if you're under 30, please join us with your camera on. If you'd like to audit, you can do so, but please just give the floor and to the students and recent graduates and keep your camera off. And then we have our book club is coming up on Monday. Professor Jason Hill is going to be sharing some of his insights on, of course, Ayn Rand's classic novella, Anthem. And next week we have some really great clubhouses with Rob Trusinski on Ayn Rand's Case for a Secular Morality. I'm doing a live interview with Isaac Morehouse on Wednesday, and the much awaited second part of Jason Hill's two-part series, Ayn Rand and Sex, is coming up next week. You will not want to miss that. So thanks everyone, and look forward to seeing you, if not tonight, then next week.